Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci, and he is out with a brand new book. This one is called Mercy. It's the latest Atlee Pine thriller. It is available everywhere, and you got to check it out. This series has been fantastic. David, these four Atlee Pine books have all centered around this lone wolf FBI agent out in the Grand Canyon area of Arizona. Twin sister Mercy has been missing for 30 years. How did the initial pitch for this series go before you got the go-ahead to start writing it?
Well, you know, it's sort of in my head. Is this going to work? Am I going to sustain this for a number of books, this underlying plot, while at the same time Atlee Pine is an FBI agent, and each book also has another mystery to solve? So I thought, you know, this is a challenge, but I think I can pull this off. And so as I was writing the first one, I was sort of laying the groundwork for books to come. At that point, I didn't know how many books I was going to write in this series. It turned out to be four, just because that really worked for the story. But there was a lot of planning that went into place, but there's also a lot of the seat-of-the-pants kind of stuff, too, that, you know, figuring things out at the last minute, because that's just the way books go, and that's just the way I sort of write. But it was nice to sort of get out of my comfort zone. I've certainly written series before, but never a series where there's this underlying major plot thread through multiple books. Usually, you know, my series character, Amos Decker, he has one story in each book, and he solves that mystery and then moves on to the next one. They're not connected. This one was all interconnected, so I had to take a little more time and a little more effort with this one.
When you say you didn't know it was going to be four books, you knew it would be multiples, though. And so as you're talking to this, did you have an idea of, I want to get this series wrapped up by 2021 or by a certain date, or how long did you think you could play it out for?
Yeah, I didn't really have a date in mind. I did know that, you know, after I'd finished the third book, it really just was on how much she knew at that point and how close she was getting. And after I'd finished Daylight, I thought, okay, this is only one more book's worth, because she's so close to the finish line, there's no way I can write two or three more books about it. It's just not enough out there for her left to discover. So that was what made number four really the stopping place, the ideal stopping place, just because that was where the plot led me to. I hate writing filler. I'm not going to just put stuff into a book to have another book out there that I shouldn't have even written. So after number three, I thought, okay, there's one more book, because there's a one book worth of additional things she needs to find out and do, but that's it.
One of the things I like about Atlee Pine, and this is true of a lot of characters in crime fiction is that, and in thriller fiction, is that they hate bureaucracy, and yet somehow they find themselves working in one of the most bureaucratic departments that there is, a police department, or in this case, the FBI. And so when you've got a character like that, how do you have her balance that natural desire for her just to get away from all the bureaucracy, yet FBI is nothing but filing reports?
It absolutely is, and that's sort of the conundrum she's faced with, and a lot of my characters are faced with. You know, John Puller's another one who kind of, like, does his own thing, but he works for the Army, which is kind of like the biggest bureaucracy in the world. So I think that speaks to her character, and what people like in thrillers and mysteries in general is conflict and confrontation, and because I put a woman who's very independent-spirited into an organization like that, there's going to be conflict built in, and I think readers really like that. It helps move a story forward. It's almost like she'll be battling people on all flanks. You know, she's battling the person she's trying to figure out where her sister is, but she's also battling the people she works with. And it makes her sort of an underdog, and readers love underdogs. And, you know, when you go to a movie, you always root for the underdog. So I think that I've tried to turn that into a positive and not a negative, even though she does have to battle that stuff. I also, you know, I tried to turn it into a strength of hers. And people, I think, applaud the fact that she figures out a way to get around the rules at times when she needs to. Because at the end of the day, as she says, she just wants to catch bad guys, you know, and she doesn't want to sit behind her desk and push paper. That doesn't help anybody. And I think most readers can really relate to that sort of, you know, philosophy.
Did you have this thought in your mind that if Atlee was ever to discover her sister alive, what emotional risks would Atlee face and that you would have to consider writing her character of how that reunification could go?
Yeah, that was that was a lot of fun and problematic for me, because I could have gone in so many different directions. You sort of hit it right on the head, and I thought long and hard about how do I want this to go. You know, do I want to hallmark it, or do I want to make it, you know, a lot more realistic? And I opted for the latter, because I was telling someone earlier that, you know, families are the most dysfunctional sort of unit there is, and we never know. It's totally unpredictable at times. We don't know what's right below the surface. We just sometimes just see what's there or what we're meant to see. So I really had to work that dynamic out, because obviously Mercy had suffered enormously after she went missing, and she was not going to be the same person. Pine had this sort of idyllic view of the six-year-old girl who always made her laugh. Well, that girl is long gone, and the one that she, you know, discovers again is someone that she has to come to terms with. It's not, she wasn't there to fit Pine's idyllic idea of what this reunion should be. It was the nitty-gritty, you know, oftentimes dirty piece of life that she needed to confront. So it was going to be, there was not going to be anything clean or smooth about it, nor should it be.
One of the things that happens in not only this book, but in a lot of your books, is you write physical fight scenes. And I have to try to picture these in my mind as the reader, as all of us do. But on the flip side of it, when you are writing a physical fight scene, how do you choreograph that in your mind? Because getting all the jabs and the body locations and all that right to have the fight make sense, that's got to be a trick. So how do you do that?
Yeah, so I think the thing that makes it work for me is whenever I need to do anything about that, I try to immerse myself in that world and find out as much as I possibly can about it. That includes going on and just watching some of the stuff, too. I'm not a huge fan of MMA, but for writing this book, I wanted to get it right. And then in my mind, you know, I can take certain details, use shorthand language, because that's what would be done between two people that know a subject matter really well. And at the end of the day, my philosophy with action is don't speed it up, slow it down. Because if I'm expecting my characters to either give out punishment or absorb punishment, I want people to understand this is really painful, this is really hurting. I'm not going to just show six jabs and the person's knocked out and you don't even know what happened. I want you to know that these people are absorbing a lot of punishment and they're bleeding and they're nicked up and they're bruised. Because I'm asking a lot of them, and I need to give it to do. I always give the example of the Western Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood, where he shoots a guy in the belly in the morning, and it takes a whole day for the guy to die, and Eastwood's talking to him throughout the whole time from a distance. And I saw that movie in the early 1990s, and I still remember that scene so vividly because Eastwood slowed it down, and that's what made it so memorable.
There's a lot of nuggets about FBI history sprinkled in this book and throughout the series, and one of the things I found interesting reading here is after the first female agent in 1922, there were several decades with no female agents. Why was that?
Because of J. Edgar Hoover. That's why. He was, let's just say he was unique and didn't think that women belonged anywhere near, you know, FBI special agent status. So he put the kibosh on that completely. It was only until he passed away in, I think, 1970, 71, where the FBI got back to recruiting special agents. And still today, you know, they're out of the 25 or 2,600 special agents, you know, I think 10 or 15% are women. On the admin side, they're, you know, the majority of people are women. And just shows, you know, that, you know, Adley Pond doesn't have it easy. Most of the people she works with are men, and she doesn't see people like her very often. And it's still, we're still very much a man's world, and she has to adapt to that, fair or not. But, yeah, FBI has been like a lot of other agencies, you know, historically male-dominated, changing, but changing slowly.
I'm chatting with David Baldacci about his brand-new Atlee Pine thriller. This one is called Mercy. It's number 4 in the series. David, this... But there's also little nuggets in the book that touch on various, I call them asides, but one is the idea of local politicians being more effective than national politicians, especially when it comes to who somebody needs to grease the wheel of. How does that argument go? Because I found it interesting.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about tentacles of power, I've always found like the farther they're stretched away, the less dominant and they become and less helpful they become. It's almost like, you know, when you're committing an arson, the source of the fire is really important, and the closer you can get to whatever you want it to be burned, the better. And I found that, you know, in the local political scenes, that's also the case, because people always talk about bread and butter, kitchen table issues and all that. Very difficult for national politicians to do anything about that immediately. They get passed big bills that will trickle down to people over, you know, years and decades. But let's say you want to get a stop sign for your local neighborhood, you want to get one curb paved, you want to get, you know, a busted pipe fixed, or you want to contact somebody that's in the local community and you really need to get to connect with them. Local people get that done really, really fast. They don't have the, you know, they don't wear the burden of the national political scene. They have their own little piece of the pie to control, and they can do it pretty well and do it pretty quickly. So I've always found that wherever you go, that's the case. If you want to get something done, just talk to someone local because their bailiwick is much, much smaller.
part of the story takes place around the Asheville, North Carolina area. What drew you to that area for a setting?
Yeah, I've been to Asheville many, many times, and I love, you know, sort of the vibe there. You know, it's got a great art scene, a great wine community there. And I knew the character that moved there, I needed to have some reason for her to be in that particular place. And the sort of work that she did there was kind of, you know, different than what you normally see in Asheville, but I thought it would be a perfect place for her to hide. Not only hide, but also continue to do what she's been doing her whole life, which is taking advantage of younger people. And it fit for me geographically as well, because it was sort of in this footprint of what I wanted. I didn't want Pine to have to crisscross the country and go here, go there, thousands of miles at a time. So to have her jog, you know, between sort of North Carolina and Georgia, and places like that really fit. I could get her to places faster than otherwise, and it just made the story move a lot faster. But yeah, I wanted to write about Asheville just because it's such a pretty place, too.
And then speaking of settings, that the Georgia areas, there's a lot of remoteness that you describe in the book, and it took me back to a story that I remember reading that you had written. It was a piece for, I think it was a British newspaper, I think it was the London Times or something like that, where you described the remote area of Virginia in which your mother was raised. Did you draw inspiration off that remoteness when you created your Georgia setting?
Yeah, I absolutely did, because I think people just don't realize that something like 75% of the United States is wilderness. You know, we think that every bit of the country has been developed and all that, but most of it is just trees and open fields, and, you know, and my mother was probably born in one of the most remotest areas on a ridge in southwest Virginia that only got electricity and running water in 2004. I know that because the Washington Post wrote a story about it. And she grew up there in the 30s and 40s, this coal mining country. And even when you go back to that today, so if you want to go from one end of Virginia to the other, so if I want to leave Fairfax County today and go to where my mother lived, and Virginia is not one of the biggest states. I think it's ranked like 39th or something in size. I could release Fairfax today at, let's say, 11 o'clock in the morning, and I would get to where my mother is in the toe of the boot in Virginia about 8.5 hours later. In that same period of time, I could drive almost to Nebraska. You know? So it's just crazy, because once you get off the interstate, the roads there are difficult, and the mountains and the side winding up and down and the switchbacks and all that, you're going 5 miles an hour. So I did. I really drew upon that experience. And I've been to Georgia, all over Georgia as well, and Georgia in some ways reminds me a lot of Virginia, in that there are a lot of places there where, you know, let's just put it the way, there's not a handy policeman to call. And life is a little bit different.
Well, this series doesn't just involve law enforcement people, but there's some really bad people that you write and the characters you write in this book. And I know you can talk to an FBI source and research procedure for law enforcement protagonists and such, but who do you interview for insight into the thinking of evil characters?
Yeah, I have read so many books on, you know, the Ted Bundys of the world and the newspaper articles, you know, people just committing, you know, the incredible acts of violence and depravity. You know, I was reading one this morning about a young woman found dead and horribly mutilated in like this granary cage that's meant for, you know, cutting up deer. And these two guys that they arrested for it in Missouri, you know, you look at the pictures on the newspaper and you're like, well, you know, not to stereotype, but you look at those guys and you're like, I would never want to meet them, not in the middle of a football stadium with 80,000 people, much less a dark alley. And there's just, unfortunately, there's a lot of depravity and sickness out there. And so you can look around and see it in lots of different places. And you can go online, and you can go through some social media and understand that a lot of people have a lot of issues and problems. And it's almost like, you know, I always look back and think about Lord of the Flies. When civilization breaks down and you have a group of people who have to sort of make their own micro-civilization, and the rules are, you know, the strongest and the ones with the strongest wills and the strongest physically dominate everyone else. And then you begin to understand that human beings are capable of anything. They're capable of incredible good, as we've seen, and they're also capable of incredibly evil things.
At one point in the book, I even jotted down in my notes the name Dick Tracy when I read this part, but a couple of the characters use something that you describe in the narrative as a small but powerful optical device. and it was to view things that were going on outside of a house. And it seemed to me like a drone, but all you used to describe it was those words, small but powerful optical device. Is this a fictional creation, or does this device actually exist?
Yeah, you know, not only the FBI, but lots of different federal agencies have devices. They need to be heat-seeking devices so they can, you know, actually look through walls and give you a silhouette of a heated presence inside, whether it's a person walking around or through. You know, NASA has a lot of technology, surveillance technology, that other agencies use, because in space, obviously, the stuff has to be really durable. It has to get through a lot of magnetic fields and a lot of disruption, a lot of different signals coming through that could mess it up. So it's really, really robust technology. So those devices exist, and they are used. You know, some of the most sophisticated optics, you know, snipers use, counter-snipers use, and you can, it used to be that you'd have to put all this information into your scope, you know, all the, and wheel it down, as they call it, wheel it down, all the logistics going in for the wind and the weather and the moisture and the dew point, the humidity and all that, anything that would impact the shot. Now you can download an app on your iPhone, anybody can do it, and it does all of that for you automatically and loads it right into your scope. I mean, so anybody can, I'm not saying everybody can be a world-class counter-sniper, and please, God, don't. but I'm just saying the technology has made this stuff a lot easier. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into being a great counter-sniper, and a lot more than just technology. But as far as that goes, that's readily available, too. It's amazing what's out there. It really is.
I know you have a real appreciation for the history of this country and the literary history in particular, but you've mentioned that Mark Twain goes hand in hand with what is remarkable about this country. So how do you correlate Twain with the remarkable parts of America?
Yeah, he spoke truth, you know, before that was really something anybody else wanted to do. He spoke truth about the country that he lived in. I wish to God he was alive today. I can only imagine what his Twitter feed would be. He was the most quoted man of his generation. He would be the most quoted man of this generation if he were still alive. He was a really astute observer of life, of politics, and everything else. So for me, he was a man who looked at the world and saw it exactly as it was and wasn't afraid to tell people his opinion of it. Nothing was sugarcoated about it. And he went after, you know, the large and the small, the rich and the poor, if they were doing bad things in his mind. He could be very vindictive and petty jealousies and all that. He was just a human being, but the sharpness of his wit and his barbs were just incredible. You know, one of the favorite quotes I have of his is "Travel is fatal to prejudice," and he was the most traveled man of his generation as well. He saw the entire world, and what he meant was that if you see people from other cultures and other countries, you'll understand quickly that even though they don't look like you or speak like you or eat like you or pray like you, that we all share that common core of humanity, and it greatly increases people's empathy for people all around the world. Because most people can't travel, the next best thing they can do is pick up a good book and read about other people from other places, and all of a sudden we're all one humanity. We're one core of humanity. So that's what I appreciate about Mark Twain. In fact, I go up this month to Hartford to give out the Mark Twain American Voice and Literature Award to Stephen Graham Jones, for The Only Good Indian, and a terrific book that really, you know, this speaks with an American voice. And when I say American voice, it doesn't even have to be about this country. It doesn't have to be in America. We've given out to people from other places. I just mean to speak with authenticity about what you're writing about, and that's what Twain did.
Are there any benevolent folks who made a charitable donation and had their names appear as any characters in this book?
I'm trying to think on Mercy. I don't think so in Mercy, but I know in the next two books I have coming out, I think I have a total of six charitable names. So we ran up quite the tally, and I'm trying to whittle it down.
Are they names that you would ever come close to coming up with in fiction?
Some of them were challenging. I held on to one name. It was a South Korean name, because I wanted to give it justice, and I wanted to have a good character, but I just wanted to plop it in the book just to have it in there. So it took me a few books, and then I finally had a Will Robey adventure where part of the novel was set in North Korea, so I was able to use that book in a really effective way. And another one, it was an assassin in The Long Road to Mercy, that I finally was able to use that name. I thought it was a good fit for that character. So I don't want it just to be, you know, one and done. You see the guy's riding up an elevator and he tells you your name and that's it. That's not what people pay for. I want to give them something of value because the money they contributed to all these different charities, you know, I really want them to feel like they got their money's worth and to respect them for what they did.
All right. Well, he's David Baldacci. The new book is Mercy. It's the latest Atlee Pine thriller. It's fantastic. Check it out. David, another great conversation. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I always enjoy it very much. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy.